DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Welcome to DW's Living Planet. I'm Sarah Steffen. It's this time of year when many people go on vacation for a well-deserved summer break. We are looking at the link between tourism and the environment in this special episode of Living Planet. Just how many visitors are too many? The Greek island of Santorini struggles with tourism numbers it can't handle.
Υπάρχει μόνο ένας τρόπος εδώ.
There is only one type of water here, desalinated. Now we have signed another contract to build another desalination plant, the biggest in Greece. And that will only cover a part of the island's needs. We need to stop the construction of new hotels.
Θα έλεγα ότι και για αυτούς τους λόγους πρέπει να μπει ένα stop.
Kenya risks losing its historic sites along its coast due to climate change.
We have realized that sites that are actually situated in the high water tides area, they are slowly being eaten away by abnormal water tides. One of our prominent sites that we have really seen this one, if we have not taken any intervention, then I think in the next 20 years or so, we may see part of Fort Jesus go to the water.
And we also hear about glaciers in New Zealand that have receded so much, it's actually become too dangerous to hike all the way to the top. Stay tuned for these stories and more. At what point does tourism become a curse rather than a blessing? Some 2 million people flocked to the Greek island of Santorini last year. There were days when up to 18,000 visitors on cruise ships were seen disembarking at the island's port. That's a lot, especially considering that only about 15,000 people actually live on the island. Santorini is struggling to cope, and the very ecology of the island is at risk. Heidi Fulalov reports from Santorini.
In the heart of the Cyclades, the whitewashed island of Santorini is on everyone's bucket list. I'm staying in a trendy Caldera cave hotel in Ia, an epicentre for the island's tourist hordes. Above me, the famous Blue Dome churches and whitewashed hotels glitter under the assault of 1,000 flashlights as crowds congregate on the castle above to cram their Instagram feeds with the sunset views for which Ia is renowned. As the sun finally descends over the spectacular volcanic crater, there are cheers and wolf whistles. It's as if the Santorini sun itself has become a performer for the tourist hordes. It's hard to imagine that barely 30 years ago, this 76-kilometre square island was a haven of peace and tranquility. Like Venice and Barcelona, Santorini is struggling to control the flow of tourists that are threatening to damage the fragile ecosystem of the island irremediably. According to a recent study by the University of the Aegean, concrete on Santorini covers around 15% of the volcanic atoll's total surface, compared to an average 1% on surrounding islands. Battling with traffic to get to the office of Mayor Nikos Zorzos in the island's capital Thera, you really just see how big the problem is here. It's not yet the high season, but already the narrow streets are congested with coaches and vans, battling for right of way with the cars of residents and tourists. Arriving at the town hall, it takes me half an hour just to find somewhere to park.
Το δυνατό, θα έλεγα, στοιχείο της Σαντορίνης.
The beauty of Santorini is its landscape, and the overdevelopment leads to thousands of problems. The first is that we face all the problems of a big city, even though we are not designed to be a big city, or to deal with these problems. The local authorities in Greece also do not have the power and means to do things. We have to ask central government to regulate local problems. We have almost 1.8 million visitors a year, but the municipality has a lack of human resources. And because of the current economic crisis, we can't employ more people. A new law was meant to change things, to give more power and more means to local authorities, but the central government blocked it, so we are back to square one.
I learned that the situation is further complicated by local inertia. Mayor Zorzos explains that even if he attempts to implement simple measures, such as one-way streets, to regulate traffic, he faces lawsuits from local businesses that are often opposed to change. Water is another huge problem on this island, where traditional cisterns dating back to the Cycladic civilization, circa 3100 to 1600 BC, have been largely abandoned, and private homes, but also hotels and businesses, rely on water that's ferried over from Crete or obtained through desalinization and illegal well withdrawals.
Υπάρχει μόνο ένας τρόπος εδώ.
There is only one type of water here, desalinated. Now we have signed another contract to build another desalination plant, the biggest in Greece, delivering 5,000 cubic meters of drinking water per day. And that will only cover a part of the island's needs. During the last 4 years, IA has increased its water needs by 110% and Akrotiri by 410%. We need to stop the construction of new hotels.
Θα έλεγα ότι και για αυτούς τους λόγους πρέπει να μπει ένα stop.
But in order to prevent land being used for building yet more hotels, Santorini needs to find viable alternatives to traditional tourism on the island. One possible solution is wine. As the global demand for Santorini wine outstrips supply, vine cultivation, encouraged by European Union grants, is starting to offer an alternative and more ecological use for local land, with some 1,300 hectares of this 7,600 hectare island now planted with vines instead of being bulldozed to build more hotels. Another new initiative that is changing the face of local tourism is Santorini Walks, a project created by owner Nikos Boutsinis 4 years ago.
There's a network of really, really pretty paths that nobody seems to be walking on. A lot of them, unfortunately, are deteriorating. Their condition is basically not very good. The terraced gardens, the terraced fields that used to cover the island in its entirety are not there anymore. So they don't grow crops anymore and the roots are not there to support the soil.
Back in Thera town, I meet Lauren Siegel, who, in affiliation with Hong Kong Polytechnic and the UK's University of Surrey, is conducting research on the effects of over-tourism in Greece and elsewhere.
Although more jobs are created and more revenue is brought into the island from tourism, the local population doesn't necessarily benefit from this. Both the locals and the tourism practitioners don't see a demand for Greek culture, so the local culture is quite watered down for tourists as a result. Furthermore, tourism causes inflation, making goods and services unaffordable for the local people. Real estate prices in Santorini have grown to be among the highest in the European Union.
Although Lauren believes that reducing the number of tourists will help reduce some of the problems linked to tourism, she doesn't think this will be the solution to cure all ills.
Santorini has joined places like Cinque Terre, Venice, and Machu Picchu in putting a cap on visitors. Although capping visitors may have a positive impact in the short term, it's more vitally important that Santorini takes a step back and reevaluates its tourism policies and infrastructure on more of a macro level.
With Mayor Zorzos's recent plea to islanders to adopt teachers and medical staff who are unable to find affordable accommodation on Santorini, an unemployment rate of 23% and the risk that over-exploitation will rapidly lead to environmental impoverishment, the need for re-evaluation certainly seems urgent for this spectacular volcanic island, which has become a victim of its own success. Heidi Fuller-Love, DW Santorini, Greece.
Just like the beautiful island of Santorini, glaciers, frozen rivers of ice, are also drawing large numbers of tourists from around the world. During peak season, over 100,000 people per month come to see one of New Zealand's most famous glaciers, for instance. But as global temperatures rise, the glaciers are retreating, and this takes a toll on the ecosystem and on tourism. David Killick has more from New Zealand.
So when we get a lot of snow landing up in that neve, this glacier will actually get higher, wider and fast enough to counteract the mounting effect.
That's Cliff Goodwin, a tour guide with Glacier Valley Eco Tours. I've joined Cliff and a bunch of American tourists hiking up a path to Franz Josef Glacier, nestled in the middle of New Zealand's South Westland. Since 2012, it's become unsafe to walk on the glacier from the valley because of a high rockfall hazard. In an earthquake zone, that's a real risk. We're now on a one-hour hike up the valley to get as close as we safely can to the glacier and enjoy a spectacular view of the mountains. Kathy, a 72-year-old retired mental health worker from Arizona, says it's worth it.
I love nature and I love the outdoors and I love everything that's on offer out here, including the glaciers. They're all going to be gone pretty soon because we're not taking very good care of our earth. So you've got to see them while you can, but they're marvelous.
Would you still come back if the glaciers were getting really small?
Probably, because they're still mountains.
Back at base, Cliff Goodwin tells me tourism companies have had to adapt as the glaciers retreat up the mountainside.
So the glacier is in fluctuation cycles, so it has advancing and retreating cycles, and every now and then it will come forward and then it will go back. So the last time it went back, it's completely impossible to get onto the glacier from the ground anymore. There's a big gorge and a river in the way. Without a bridge, it's impossible to actually get onto the glacier for anybody. But the numbers still keep coming, so we seem to have more and more tourists here than we used to.
About an hour's drive north, glaciologist Dr. Brian Anderson has built a family home tucked into the hillside. It's got views of the ocean and the mountains, which is where he spends a lot of his time. Anderson, who's with the Antarctic Research Centre at Victoria University of Wellington, says last summer was the hottest on record in New Zealand, and that's had a big impact on the glaciers. An aerial survey showed that most of them didn't have any snow left on them at all. If glaciers don't get snow, because it isn't cold enough, they can't form more ice, so they'll begin to retreat. Franz Josef Glacier retreated through the 20th century until 1983 because of rising temperatures, then advanced after a series of cool years in the early 1980s and mid-1990s. Now it's retreating again.
Since 2008, it's gone back 1.4 kilometres. So that is it's a big retreat and it's happened really fast. There's no doubt that the reason they retreated is because it's got quite a lot warmer. And we know that the reason the Earth is getting warmer is because of anthropogenic climate change. So the link is quite clear, but there's also this natural variability which complicates the issue. So this, you know, spectacular advance in the middle of this great retreat.
This retreat is linked to higher sea temperatures, he says.
There's a really strong link with sea temperature, especially off the west coast here. And so record hot summer, it's also the hottest that the Tasman parts of the Tasman Sea have been as well. And it's also the glaciers have shown their greatest mass loss measured. So all these things are really, really closely linked.
What do you think is going to happen in the future? Are the glaciers going to retreat completely? Are they going to disappear altogether?
They won't disappear altogether because the mountains are really high. So they're, you know, this mountain's more than 3,000 metres high. These are going to have snow and ice on them, even if it's much, much warmer. But what we may lose is these steep, spectacular tongues that come down to the valleys where people can come and visit them easily. That's what's really at risk. And if you look at some projections of glaciers in the future that I've been working on, then there's a real choice between whether we, you know, really try and mitigate our greenhouse gas emissions, really make some changes to how we operate as a society. And in that case, the glaciers will keep retreating, but you know, you'll still be able to see them from the car park, from walking up the valley. But if we don't, like if we just go as a business as usual, just keep on pumping out greenhouse gases, then the glaciers are going to get really small. They're going to retreat way up into the mountains. They'll still be there, but they're going to be really hard to visit, really hard to see.
Anderson is now part of a team working on proving the link between glacial loss and human-caused climate change. But with warmer-than-average temperatures continuing so far this year, it seems unlikely the glaciers will stop retreating anytime soon. David Killick, DW, Christchurch, New Zealand.
This is DW's Living Planet with me, Sarah Steffen. In just a little while, we'll hear how Kenya is at risk of losing its historic sites due to climate change. But first, have you heard of DW Discoveries? It's bite-sized portions of interesting environment, science, and health news. Right now, DW Discoveries is available on smartphones that have the Google Assistant app on them and on Google Home devices. It works like this. You say, OK, Google, open DW Discoveries, and you get an interesting piece of information, just like this environment discovery from my colleague Gabriel Bowerd.
Hey, this is Gabriel. If you go down to the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise, especially if you're a gang of Australian scientists. Instead of going down to the woods, you go up into the highlands in Fiji. Through a 3-year study, the scientists found at least 17 new native species of bees, where previously it was thought there were only 3. The problem is that the native bees are pollinating weeds that were themselves introduced to the Fijian highlands, so they're not native. And the scientists say the plants are spreading at an alarming rate, and that could be a major threat to the Pacific Islands ecosystems.
The East African country of Kenya is battling with some major environmental challenges. As sea levels rise due to climate change, its monuments and historical sites by the coast are at risk of disappearing. Diana Wanyuni went out exploring in the coastal city of Mombasa.
Walking down the narrow streets of the old town in Kenya's second city of Mombasa, the sounds of Taarabu, traditional Swahili music, drift on the air. Beautifully hand-carved wooden doors and faded walls built from coral and lime line the streets. These were, in the 15th century, King Philip I of Portugal ordered Fort Jesus to be built to guard the old port of Mombasa. Viewed from the air, it takes the shape of a man. In 2011, UNESCO declared it a World Heritage Site, celebrating it as one of the most outstanding and well-preserved examples of Portuguese military fortification. But having stood tall for more than half a millennium, this colossal stone edifice is under threat. Built to withstand the onslaught of invading armies, the fort's defenses are being breached by high tides and fierce ocean winds. Athman Hussein, Regional Assistant Director at the National Museum of Kenya, says all along Kenya's coast, from Lamu Archipelago in the north of Mombasa to the south, the story is the same.
Over the last 10 years, we have observed that water tides in the coastal region of Kenya, from northern part of Lamu, even down to the southern part of Kenya, we have realized that sites that are actually situated in the high water tides area, they are slowly being eaten away by abnormal water tides. One of our prominent sites that we have really seen this one, if we have not taken any intervention, then I think in the next 20 years or so, we may see part of Fort Jesus go to the water.
Dr. Charles Magori shares his concern. Magori is a senior researcher at the Kenya Marine and Fisheries Research Institute. He says the culprit is climate change. Higher temperatures cause the ocean to swell, while melting ice caps increase the volume of water.
Rises in mean sea level by only a few tens of centimeters could result in loss of land due to erosion and inundation of low-lying coastal areas, saltwater intrusion into coastal ecosystems and into groundwater systems, and loss of terrestrial and marine biodiversity. This could result in wide economic, cultural, and ecological repercussions.
That's been compounded by unusually high rainfall, resulting in floods in many areas of the country. Human lives have been lost, and here in Mombasa, two of the old town's historic buildings collapsed. One was a 250-year-old staircase used by Arabs to enter the then state house, now known as Levin House. Athman Hussein has his office in this very building, but the damage can be seen all across the city, he says.
The building stock within the Old Town of Mombasa is really in bad shape. There are very few buildings which we can say that they're in a good condition. Many of the people who have inherited the buildings, they seems to be not so much interested to conserve, but rather they want to bring them down and come up maybe a six-story building so that they can get more rental income.
Abdul Swamad Abdallah Ali is in charge of preserving the ancient staircase, an ongoing project, he explains.
This staircase in front of us, we have restored around 15 years ago. Now it's in danger due to climate changes and a lot of rain in Mombasa. I'm advising the locals in order to prevent this situation, to restore their building, to check the stability of the buildings, which currently around 22 buildings in Mombasa is in the state of danger.
As he's explaining the problem, Abdallah Ali spots a man heading towards the collapsed staircase and politely warns him in the local Swahili dialect spoken in Mombasa region.
Boss.
More than 70 historic buildings in this coastal region are under threat. They include the Vasco da Gama Pillar, built in 1498 by the Portuguese explorer of the same name as a sign of appreciation for the welcome he was given by the Sultan of Malindi. One of Africa's oldest colonial monuments, its future is now on shaky ground as a surging ocean erodes its coral base. Hussein says unless something is done soon, it won't be there for future generations to enjoy.
The pillar which is there right now is actually the beacon, not only in terms of navigation, but also the friendship between the Portuguese, the local sultan. It was standing in a place which nobody would have thought it will come to be threatened by the very strong tides as well as the waves, and including the winds. So right now, the rock has been eaten from the high water mark where the pillar stands. It's exactly 3 meters. If we are going to leave it that way, I can assure you that in the next 10 years, the pillar will come down.
And losing such monuments could have an economic impact too. Sam Ikwai of the Kenya Association of Hotel Keepers is urging the government to act fast to restore the sites.
We have people who want to travel to Mombasa, people want to travel to the coast region because of the rich history that's associated with the coast region. And therefore, this is likely to affect this kind of visitors and travelers. We must be cautious about as a country, because then we're losing serious heritage. It's sad and calls for urgent action by the would-be authorities to try and put in place conservation mechanisms to try and protect and conserve what is left.
Low-lying areas like Lamu are among the first to see destruction that climate change can wreak. And as more and more locations around the world begin to suffer from extreme weather events, things will only get worse for those already on the front line. Scientist Charles Magori again.
An island like Lamu in the next 50 years, it is projected that during what we call high water springtide, about 50% of the island is going to be inundated with water if the current data and trend is anything to go by. So therefore, what this means is that all the coastal infrastructures that are constructed close to the sea will definitely be affected.
For DW, this is Diana Wanyonyi in Mombasa, Kenya.
And for our last report, we head to the lush rainforest in Costa Rica. Rainforest tours in the Central American country are a major draw for tourists. Costa Rica has been hailed as a green role model as it runs almost completely on renewables. But that comes at a price, as Anne-Kathrin Mehlmann found out. Her report is presented by Ruby Russell.
Alexandra Grinninger trudges through dense undergrowth in snake-proof rubber boots. Grinninger bought this land more than 20 years ago with her father, a German agricultural engineer. Back then, the plot on the Ravantazon River was empty pasture, cleared of rainforest. One of its two lakes was poisoned with pesticides. Today, the lush jungle is home to more than 250 species of bird, including this rare specimen.
This is a green macaw, a large parrot.
They're highly endangered. My father planted many trees, among them the almendro, which is also endangered. We planted a lot of them because the green macaws like the fruit it produces, almonds. Now I'm seeing them here more and more often. They're beautiful birds.
When Gröninger first saw monkeys settle in this green oasis, she cried with joy. Until the Costa Rican Institute of Electricity, or ICE, forcibly expropriated 70 hectares to build a major hydroelectric power plant. The Revantazon Dam is Central America's largest construction after the Panama Canal. And it went ahead even though the area is considered high risk due to frequent landslides and is home to endangered species such as the jaguar. The dam has flooded hundreds of acres of forest. Costa Rica is a mountainous country with a wealth of waterways. It's famous for having a close to 100% renewable power supply. Much of that electricity comes from 50 hydropower plants. 77% of ICE's electricity is generated this way. But activist Mauricio Alvarez, who has studied the environmental impact of these dams, says renewable power isn't always environmentally friendly.
In tropical regions, overall biomass production and ecosystem productivity are much higher. In dams, decomposition processes produce more methane gas than a coal-fired power plant. So power generation by hydroelectric power plants in tropical ecosystems is problematic.
Methane gas is a climate killer around 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And the ecological damage doesn't stop there. Alvarez says fish and plants are dying off, and coastal mangrove forests are no longer getting the nutrients they need from rivers. The slopes of the gigantic dam are stubbled with stumps of dead trees. These were revealed when it was drained earlier this year to fix a leak. Usually, trees are cut down and removed before a reservoir is filled with water. Otherwise, large amounts of methane are released as they decay. This is a requirement of the environmental standards of the financial institutions that approve loans for such projects. In the case of the Revantazon Dam, these institutions were the Inter-American Development Bank, the World Bank and the European Investment Bank, meaning that German taxes have been sunk into the $1.5 billion project. The Gröninger family, forced off their land, lodged a complaint with the banks over environmental damage from the dam. Since 2016, authorities have been investigating the issue, but so far they haven't come up with any answers.
According to geologists, water is slowly leaking from the lake. We need to monitor the situation. Geologists have said the ICE should build a protective wall here. There are many landslides. The whole area is geologically unstable.
Photos, videos and geological studies have documented these problems. But ICE Director Javier Orozco denies the forest was cleared illegally. That trees were not felled before the reservoir was filled was deliberate, he says. They helped stabilise the slopes once they were inundated. The European Investment Bank said in a statement that its regulations were meant to be enforced. The Gröningers are seeking compensation and for the environmental damage to be repaired or, at the very least, acknowledged. Theirs is an isolated case. ICE, a public company, is protected by special laws and rarely has to face lawsuits. But Revantazon isn't the only hydropower plant in Costa Rica to face resistance. An even larger project in the south of the country was halted by indigenous activists. There, at least, human and environmental rights trumped economic concerns.
Ruby Russell with that report by Anne-Kathrin Mellmann. And that's our show for this week. For more Living Planet, go to dw.com/livingplanet, where you'll find links to our media center and our podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for DW Environment. Thanks very much from all of us in the studio, Eliane Gagliarducci, Karin Hennecke and me, Sarah Steffen. Bye for now.